Our topic this morning is analysis of climate policies under large uncertainty about climate change. Uncertainty, certainly, and complexity, certainly. So, while I apologise for our international delegates in that I think we'll focus on Australian policy and Australian issues, hopefully the discussion will be relevant to our overseas friends as well. And what I'll do is we'll have a bit of a discussion up here and hopefully then open up to a wider discussion of the audience. And I'll do the best I can to keep it under 30 minutes, which will be a tough ask, I think. Before we start, I'm going to ask each of the panellists to give their view of what their understanding is of the imperfections and the uncertainties of this climate change issues. If I may ask you, John, to give your views on this, please.
Thank you, and thank you to CEDA for the invitation here today. Certainly the certainty around the science is clarifying, and it's actually getting quite scary in terms of where we're heading and above the projections that we have. We've just released today a report summarising the post-IPCC science that date shut off in mid-2006 for the science that was considered. So we've done a summary of that, and some copies available at the reception that's on our website, about the evidence of accelerated climate change. And that shows that when we're talking about levels of pollution, levels of warming, level of ice melt, all of these are above the predictions and projections right now. And so the window of opportunity for a smooth transition to a low-carbon, clean energy economy is closing, and closing fast, but in no way has it closed just yet. Just in keeping this opening short, I did want to, and I noted that one of the reports in the papers that you have here contemplates a 650 part per million scenario for the climate. That's an extreme scenario. That's extreme in terms of the impacts, extreme in terms of the warming, extreme in terms of the lives lost and displaced. And even when we consider the 550 parts per million scenario, that is estimated to be an 82% chance of overshooting 2 degrees warming. And it's around those warmings that we start to, and Ben perhaps to go into this a little bit more, about runaway climate change, when our sinks start to turn into sources and we really get into some uncertain territory. It is within our wit, our capacity, and ability to grow the economy, continue to grow the economy, to shoot for a 400 to 450 parts per million target, and that should be our unremitting focus right now. There's a whole range of modelling out there which shows that we can continue economic growth at that rate. 650 parts per million, frankly, is ridiculous, but is also imprudent when it comes to risk management.
Thanks, John. We'll have more of that. Anna, your thoughts?
Thanks very much, Eric. Okay, well, we've heard quite a lot this morning already about some of the uncertainties around the science of climate change, and we had two fabulous presentations on that front. The IPCC, in its third assessment report, quite famously attempted to estimate the contributors to uncertainty in terms of working out what climate change might mean in terms of global mean surface temperature change. And it attributed about 50% of the uncertainty to the science, and the other 50% it attributed to the economics. Now, on top of this, I think there's a third factor that we need to overlay, and that, of course, is the massive uncertainties relating to the politics of dealing with this issue. Now, in terms of the economics and the uncertainties around that, obviously when you're making projections over very long time frames in the order of 100 to 200 years, there's going to be significant uncertainties around those projections the further you move out from the projection start point. And a good illustration, I think, of this as well, and just more generally the uncertainties in the economics, is if you look at some of the scenario families that were presented in the SRES report, the Special Report on Emission Scenarios that was put out by the IPCC in 2000. And if you take just one of those scenario families, the A1 family, there's in fact a differential of around 90 gigatons of carbon dioxide at the global scale in 2100, just between the A1 FI scenario, which is a fossil fuel intensive scenario, and the A1T scenario, which is a clean technology scenario. And the only difference really in the assumptions underlying those different scenarios relate to technological change. But of course there's also a vast number of assumptions we could make with respect to economic growth and population growth over time as well. With regard to the political uncertainties, obviously what we have here with climate change is a problem of the global commons, and one, in fact, of unprecedented proportions. Now, Australia alone, as a relatively small emitter in the scheme of things, cannot, in reality, solve this problem on its own. So as such, I think the question then becomes one of magnitude, and you know, what is a reasonable, sensible and efficient policy response for Australia to adopt in a unilateral sense, given that many of our international competitors and other countries in general are not looking like taking on targets anytime soon. And you know, there are several factors that we need to consider in this, of course, and one of those is, as I mentioned, Australia is, you know, a small emitter in the scheme of things, about 1.5% of global emissions. We're also incredibly heavily trade exposed in terms of our exports of minerals and energy commodities. But on the other side, we also have a lot of brilliant talent in Australia with respect to R&D and clean technology development, and we also, I think most people would agree, punch above our weight in the international negotiations. Just to put it out there, I suppose, up front, I think what we need in Australia in responding to this issue, given all of the above, is a carbon price signal, a moderate signal that rises steadily over time, and one that generates additional certainty rather than promulgates more uncertainties into this already incredibly uncertain environment that we're trying to deal with. I think we need to increase the amount of funding that's available for R&D for clean energy technologies, engage more vigorously with our developing country counterparts and other nations in general on bilateral agreements to try and reduce emissions. And I think also crucially, understand better what the climate impacts mean for our country in terms of the climate change that's already in the system, so that we can implement better adaptation responses.
Thanks, Anna.
Ben, your thoughts?
Thanks, Eric. I'd like to thank CETA for inviting me. It's fantastic to have this forum where really the nuclear service of Australia and the world in terms of business and science and policy is getting together. I really want to follow up a little bit on what Graham and Ronald was talking about in terms of the science. Now, the uncertainties in the science, if you look back 35 years ago, 1972, J.S. Sawyer, he was an atmospheric chemist. He was a British atmospheric chemist. He predicted what the temperatures were going to be by the year 2000. And what he said, he saw the atmospheric trajectory of CO2 and said, okay, it's going to be about 25% more by the year 2000. And he said, roughly, the world should warm about 0.6 degrees in that period of time. If you look at the observations of what happened, the world's warmed about 0.5 degrees. And this is going back 35 years ago. A scientist really predicting quite well what the temperature is going to respond to our increase in greenhouse gas emissions. Now, that's in saying that, it's really I wanted to point that out because the science has been there for actually over 100 years, if we go back even longer, in terms of what greenhouse gases do to our climate. And I have a third-year undergraduate class, and at the first looking at climate change, and the lecture I give them is a calculation which calculates the natural greenhouse effect. Because if we didn't have the greenhouse gases that were already up in the atmosphere, it's only 0.3% of the atmosphere is made up of greenhouse gases. If we didn't have that 0.3%, our average temperature on Earth would be minus 18 degrees Celsius. The average temperature on Earth is about 15 degrees Celsius. So the natural greenhouse gases that are already there are actually have warmed or have created the conditions to which our civilization has actually prospered. So what we are doing is perturbing that system beyond the natural levels and really extending beyond the natural system. So that's really the natural greenhouse effect, and its perturbation from us is really set in stone. The temperature, there's not much uncertainty about the temperature prediction, but really the real uncertainty is with what comes back to Graham and Ronald was talking about, is really what the temperature, how that is going to affect things, so the indirect impacts associated with that. And that's in relation to really what they were talking about in terms of dangerous climate change. What is the level of warming to which constitutes dangerous climate change? And that really, science, we cannot say we cannot say to certainty what level is dangerous. It's a judgment call. Glaciologists don't know the point to which Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheet will collapse in terms of warming. So we don't know that. But do we want to risk that? Is it 2 degrees? Is it 3 degrees? Is it 4 degrees? We don't know. So I guess in terms of the uncertainties, we really need to think about, well, where is dangerous climate change? Does it come from a socioeconomic background? Does it come from socioeconomic impacts? For example, there's a billion people in Asia who depend on the Himalayas for their water supply. Now, in time, that water supply, it's like a savings account from the glaciers. In time, that's a huge risk of a dwindling water security supply for a billion people. That's a huge risk. What about the heat wave in 2003 in Europe? That killed 30,000 people. Now, from all the science is saying, that heat wave cannot be explained by natural causes. You have to invoke greenhouse gas warming to trigger such an extreme event in 2003. Is that dangerous climate change? Now, Rajendra Pachauri, who's the chairman of the IPCC, he actually thinks we're already there. We're already actually at the dangerous level. We need to start doing things. We need to start reducing emissions today. I'm sort of that belief. I think we need to really be quite ambitious, and if we don't get to that ambitious stage, then that's something we can consider. But the one point I did want to make, though, in terms of the issues here, really we want to, as I said, we want to say, okay, do we want it 2 degrees or 6 degrees, which is really absurd. The thing is, and I think Anna talked about this just then. If we stopped emitting tomorrow, there was no greenhouse gas emissions coming from anywhere tomorrow, we still are going to warm about 0.6 degrees because of the inertia in the system. So when talking about mitigation, and it's fundamentally important to talk about that as a priority, we also really need to look at adaptation in terms of infrastructure, equity issues, because the developing world is going to be really hurt from the warming that's already embedded in the system. So there are a number of issues to be explored here and discussed. And finally, I think from a scientific point of view, is the thing that is lagged behind is the economics. For me, the economic impact has not been looked at in detail. And that's where I think, particularly in Australia, and this is also in many parts of the world, what is the economic impact of climate change in terms of these scenarios, 2 degrees to 6 degrees warming? Whether it's infrastructure in ports, water security, lengthening prolonged droughts, extreme events, if we talk to in the insurance industry. this hasn't been looked at in detail, and by formulating a policy to hopefully transition towards a low carbon economy, we need to understand what the impacts of doing nothing would be. So I'll leave it there.
Thanks, Ben. Anna, we've heard a lot about the science and the uncertainties. Do we know enough about the economics of it all?
That's a good question, Eric, and I think we'd have to say probably not. I mean, as I mentioned in my opening spiel, over very long time frames, of course, you get significant forecaster error, as we like to call it, and there are numerous drivers of the projections of emissions, which of course then feed into our scientific understanding of the problem. Some of the drivers that I mentioned previously, there's population change, which I guess is probably one of the lesser sources of uncertainty in terms of the projections, because it's relatively static. There's also uncertainties around how economies will develop over time, so economic growth, and of course you have to overlay on top of that some of these impacts that we're already starting to see resulting from climate change. And then of course there's technological change, which I think is a massive uncertainty with respect to how the projections will evolve over time. I think, you know, who would have thought about half of, even, you know, a third or a quarter of the technologies that we have today 50 or 70 or 100 years ago. So I think, you know, there's significant uncertainty on the economic side of this, certainly.
Yeah, I'd love to join in on that. I think it has been a great shame that we haven't had Treasury and others doing more modelling on this over the last decade or so. But it's pretty clear that most of the work that's done today does show that we can do this, continue economic growth. For example, we, in a report called Making the Switch, we commissioned McClellan, Magazanics and Associates, who do the energy modelling for Commonwealth and state governments, to have a look at what are the impacts if we're, and the most cost-effective pathways to cut emissions from the electricity sector by about 80% by 2050. Because the electricity sector is about a third of Australia's greenhouse emissions. They're going to have to actually carry a fair bit of the load if we're going to have significant reductions that Australia and other developed countries will need. And that showed that if we actually had a mix of emissions trading, clean energy target and energy efficiency target, and remembering that we're one of the worst performers in the developed world on energy efficiency, and as the report out today shows, we're amongst the worst in actual power generation when it comes to carbon emissions, that we could actually, this is very affordable to make those sorts of reductions. It would see an impact on the proportion of households' expenditure on electricity in 2030 of less than half of 1% as being spent on electricity. You can actually keep some of these prices down. That matches a broader range of modelling that's there, that if we get going now, then we can avoid a lot of the worst impacts, and also a lot of stranded assets and the like. And I think that's one of the risks of having a 550 strategy, because if the science emerges and the impacts start to really kick in, then we're going to see great clamour for a much more urgent action, and we might have to be stranding assets and making some quite dramatic things. I just want to, just one other thing, Eric, is this suggestion that Australia is 1.5% of the world's pollution means that we should just sort of sit back, a bit confused, bit of a maybe mixed metaphors there, but apparently we punch above our weight, but we've got to sit in the corner. For me, it's actually we're very exposed. If China and India wake up that it's in their national interest to avoid the Himalayan glacier melts, as some of the impacts that are starting to kick in there in the US, and go for dramatic reduction, they're not going to wait around for Australia to sort of fix up its act. They're going to make changes to the global economy which will have serious impacts. The prudent risk management approach is for us to make the switch to a clean energy economy much faster.
Ben, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the economics. Really, Michael Molitor is a colleague of mine. He puts it in a very eloquent way, I think. To avoid a 2-degree warming in the future, we'll need to avoid 600 billion tonnes of carbon. This is over a period of a century. Now, if there's a $20 carbon price to to avoiding those emissions, that's a $12 trillion market. So really, the economic opportunities to grab in this emerging age is just phenomenal. So I think it's completely independent and irrelevant that we're 1% of the emissions, because our companies, our scientists, our innovators, one lab can actually grab a big slice of that $12 trillion market that's out there. We live in a global economy, so I don't think the 1% issue is really is relevant. Added to that, if we take that to the further extent, most of the European countries are around 2 to 3%. And if you add up all the countries who have a few percent, it's about half the emissions of the world are in those countries. So it's sort of it's a definite delay mechanism, I think. But I think it's better to look at the opportunities rather than the delay mechanisms in looking forward to a cleaner technology future.
Anna, a lot has been said about the cost of especially ambitious targets, and how it's going to have a huge impact on the energy supply, particularly the electricity sector. Have we done enough sort of analysis of the opportunities that Ben's talking about and perhaps John's referring to as well? I mean, have we, because our impact in the global emissions is small, John, you have to admit. But and we can only do so much internally. Can we have a larger impact economically even out of this situation internationally?
I think to answer the question, Eric, no, there hasn't been enough analysis done at this point in time about the implications of different targets on Australia's economy. That is in fact a process that was underway within the Federal Treasury prior to the election being called. They were modelling a range of different targets for Australia to see what the impacts would be on the Australian economy and sectors and states specifically. Of course, the Labor Party has come out and promoted a target of 60% emissions reductions by 2050 relative to current levels, which is in alignment with the UK's goal for a similar aspirational target. And there certainly hasn't been, at this point in time, I don't think, sufficient analysis of what the ramifications of a target like that would be for Australia and its industries. Now, in terms of my earlier comment about Australia being a relatively small emitter in the global context, I think that that's indisputable. That doesn't mean, however, that we should do nothing. It's not saying that we should sit in a corner and do nothing about this problem. What I'm advocating is a sensible and rational policy approach where we have a carbon price signal that rises smoothly over time so that we can transition our economy in an efficient manner so that we're not wasting resources that could be better spent in other uses, because of course every policy has an opportunity cost and we must bear those things in mind when we're formulating responsible public policy. In terms of deep emissions cuts, as I would define a 60% emission reduction. If you take, for example, an ABARE projection of Australia's emissions over that time frame to 2050, in a business as usual setting, you would see around 820 million tonnes, excluding land use change forestry by 2050, and a 60% reduction off 2000 levels would bring you back to about 200 million tonnes. Now that, by anyone's calculation, I think is a massive reduction. And we're not going to achieve those sorts of reductions without massive transformational change across the Australian economy, massive reductions in emissions from all sectors. And if we want to do that, that's something for policymakers to decide, but I think that we should all be informed, at the very least, about what that means in terms of Australia's sectors and what it means in terms of voters' hip pockets. Now, you may think that sounds rather cynical, but if we try and adopt targets that are not realistic or achievable, then what you might see in the future is policy backflips, which will only lead to price volatility and even greater uncertainty in this environment, because essentially the end-use consumer who's going to feel the vast effects of these policies are also voters. So we have to bear those things in mind also when we're formulating responsible policy.
John, is 60% achievable? And if not, what do we expect our policy makers to... What sort of signals does the community want to make sure that we've got intergenerational equity, international equity, but make sure our economy is robust and does not suffer inequitably? How do we do all this?
Well, look, I think 60% is very achievable. We're doing some modelling right now, which we'll share with people shortly, and we're looking at a range of scenarios, including, in fact, being carbon neutral, getting 100% reductions by 2050. We're actually going to have a look at that. And under all scenarios, there's strong continued economic growth for Australia. We'll give you that. You can have a good look at all the assumptions of those in some coming time. But again, it's about taking hold of some of the opportunities here. It's about putting in place some of the technologies and positioning Australia for the global clean energy economy that we actually must have if we're going to avoid dangerous climate change. What do Australians want? We've been doing significant polling and tracking over the last couple of years, and they want leadership on this. We just recently conducted two sets of polls, one before the election campaign began and one the weekend before last. And in fact, it actually, over the course of the campaign, it grew as a matter of serious influence on their voters, climate change. People wanted decisive action. They didn't buy. We did this the weekend after their squabble over what should happen post-2012 regarding developing countries. And in fact, what happened, both major parties went backwards, because when we asked people, they wanted Australia to be in a leadership position on that. And so I think Australians actually want to be in a position of leadership. As I said before, I think the hip, so-called hip pocket thing is dramatically overstated many, many times. But one also shouldn't forget the impacts that are coming. The fire weather conditions, the other research that we've also did recently with the CRC for bushfires and Bureau of Meteorology. I wasn't actually seeking a sort of 2-degree lineation of this, but it was actually very striking that if global warming goes above 2 degrees, we get exponential increases in fire weather conditions. We get catastrophic fire weather conditions. These guys had to invent two new sections on the pie chart that we're all familiar with as we drive around the countryside. They put it very extreme and catastrophic. Now, catastrophic is the kind of fire weather conditions that Canberra experienced when it had its bushfire. And under the projections, we'll see many more of those, up to one every 3 years, of catastrophic fire weather conditions, whether they translate to actual bushfire, around some of our southeastern capital cities. Now, I can tell you, if that stuff's going on, voters are going to want some action, they're going to want it quick, and they're not going to worry if some businesses are a little stranded during that as well.
Yeah, but voters may not be aware of the costs. I've been given instructions. Sorry, Anna. Sorry, Ben. We can keep talking depending on the audience participation bit. I'm going to open it for questions from the delegates. Second row here.
John Pitt from Pitt and Sherry. Every time I come to one of these things, it seems to me that the risks associated with some of the non-linearities are increasing. Yet, at a policy level, the vacillation continues. And I think, from a policy point of view, a lot of this stems from the adversarial nature of our political system. The question I wanted to put was, at what point should we consider something like a war cabinet-type concept to make the sort of changes that, from what we're hearing from the science this morning, are required earlier rather than later?
That's a
I can go at a couple of those.
John.
Firstly, I think it's been fascinating to me about how it's working across the political spectrums internationally. And in fact, climate change is something which has come out of the left because of concerns about the environment. But obviously, today we're talking about things of pretty serious economic management effort and impact as well. So it's across the spectrum. And internationally, we're seeing conservative parties not wanting the parties of the centre or centre-left to have ownership of the brand of action on climate change. So we all know, of course, about Arnie, but there's David Cameron in the UK, there's Angela Merkel in Germany, positioning their party so they're not left behind on that. So I think we're seeing actually some far better options between the parties overseas than, frankly, we're being offered right now. I was actually getting hopeful there for a moment. We certainly welcomed the Prime Minister's commitment to emissions trading scheme and the clean energy target. They were breaking into a bit of a trot there for a little while, but it seems to have the horse seems to be put back in the stable during the campaign. But and I certainly would want to be in a position a bit more like UK, where there is quite a robust debate, but it's about moving forward and how do we do this. And a war cabinet, people might snicker about this, but actually once we start to get to some of these serious levels of impact and we start to look at emergency conditions, we're going to have to deal with things that we've not dealt with before, or perhaps the war is the right scenario. So if some of these impacts that we're talking about do start to really hit home, we're going to have to look at new ways and new leadership on climate change in the coming decades.
I always point out the war. I guess I really like that analogy, because if you last night, I don't know if this is true or not, the costs of the war on terror, I think it was Iraq and Afghanistan, were $1.5 trillion, apparently. There was some estimate that came out of the congressional budget. $1.5 trillion on Iraq and Afghanistan, so that's a massive injection of funds into a problem, right? So I guess the comment I'd like to make is that really the economics or our markets haven't collapsed from this $1.5 trillion investment. So, you know, in terms of climate change, what about putting a pie of that into R&D, for example, into these new clean technologies? I think Australia invests $100 million a year in energy R&D. This is just public, not private. And really, if you think about this $12 trillion pie that's out there in this coming century, the new corporations, I'm sure a number here, and adapted corporations, are really going to be like the pharmaceutical companies of today. Pharmaceutical companies of today, really, they invest 20% of their revenues in R&D to get those cutting-edge products. But to do that, you need a carbon price. And in the carbon age, for corporations and the businesses here to invest in R&D at that level, you obviously have to need a long-term certainty of a carbon price. And that's why these carbon targets are very important, because the carbon target sets the price. So from my point of view, the new age is really corporations investing a lot of R&D into these new technologies and exploiting that and having getting the fruits of their success in terms of the revenues generating from those exports.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment with respect to policy vacillation, I suppose, as you put it. I think that what we need to sort of remember when we're thinking about this issue is that it is a global commons problem. Therefore, we do need a global solution to this. We need to engage all major emitters in preparing a solution for this. At the international level, of course, we have a vast range of different countries who have very, very different imperatives in terms of their developmental goals and their current economic status and their aspirations for the future. So I think we can't necessarily assume that all countries of the world have the same zest to deal with this particular environmental problem at this point in time that rich countries such as ourselves might have. And I think that reflects back into Australia's policy approach on this issue, because, of course, whilst ever the international community and our trade competitors are not acting on this issue, then it is more difficult for Australia to implement a stringent policy approach to this. And so I think you'd find very few people who are suggesting these days that we should do nothing about this. The question is one of magnitude and one of adopting sensible policies given that international environment that we are trying to deal with at the moment. So far as my colleague here's comments go with respect to the impacts of climate change, I think there's a lot of sort of misinformation that seems to be spread around in the media that seems to suggest that, you know, if Australia acts on climate change now, then somehow we can avert, you know, the bushfire dangers and we can save the Barrier Reef. And it's just simply not true. Without the international community responding to this issue, we are not going to have any impact at the 1.5% level on the global climate. Certainly there are demonstration effects, and you know, the fact that Australia is doing something, we can perhaps encourage some of the other countries to adopt similar targets. But the reality is, without China and India on board, we're not going to make significant inroads into this problem. So far as your idea of a war chest goes, I think that's probably an excellent idea. Put some money aside from each economy, deal with using that money to fund R&D into clean energy technologies, and in fact the idea of bilateral and plurilateral agreements working on the basis of R&D that deal with economies' resource bases. For example, China and Australia obviously have some basis in coal and requiring clean coal technology over time, and that is an issue that Brian Fisher and myself raised in a paper that we wrote for this CEDA conference. It would be an excellent idea and probably a much better use of our resources than wasting them on fruitless international agreements such as Kyoto.
Can I just a point of clarification, Your Honour, or Mr Speaker, or whatever we should say. I'm certainly not, the Climate Institute is certainly not saying that we can stop all of that just by Australia's action alone. What I'm pointing out is that Australia has those things at stake, and it's why it's in our interest to be very robust and right out there in the middle of that arena and punching above our weight. We've done this before and played a great role as a middle power, and so that's very important for Australia to do. And what are some of the roles of China and India and the like? Actually, the IPCC, I'm not sure if Graham mentioned before, that the scenario we need to do to avoid the 2 degrees or so has global pollution peaking and dropping from before 2015. There are scenarios there that if developed countries, remember, who have probably put about 75 to 80% of the gunk that's up in the air right now, do take some substantial reductions and some leadership and some responsibility on this, then we can have a measured program of developing countries coming on board. So, for example, South Korea, which is high per capita GDP and emissions, they should be actually looking at emissions reduction targets in the post-2012. But countries like China and India, we need to be looking at other measures which help curb their increase in pollution. So there are ways going forward, but it's absolutely vital in Australia's national interests that we're in leadership and not holding back progress.
Can I some more?
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, it won't be quick.
More questions.
Thank you. Well, Australia... Australia, with 20 million people or so, we are emitting one-third of India's emissions. And per capita emissions is perhaps larger than the United States. But that's not the... I'm particularly encouraged by this panel, which is concerned about global inequity. And we, in India, we are emitting 4% of world's emissions. It is our per capita emission is 1 ton per person, and it is 1/4 of the global world average. But that's not the issue right here. Issue is adaptation burden. Who will bear And there are about a few hundred million people who do not even have electricity, and they are the ones who will suffer most, whether who emits or not. So one has to look at the global perspective, and I'm glad that this panel is concerned about that. And we would like to see Australian leadership as well as other people's leadership here to solve the problem and march forward.
Is this, Ben, maybe, is this an opportunity for Australia to sell cleaner technology and renewables to a world that's waiting to be fed and to be housed and to have energy and electricity in their houses?
Well, I think it really is. It's a massive opportunity for developed nations because we have the intellectual capital to build and develop those new technologies of this age. And so when, obviously, I think China and India, for example, I think it's, given their situations in terms of the number of people in poverty, it's going to be very difficult to ask them to somehow sacrifice $1 more of energy in the coming decades. But over time, if we developed the technologies for them to use down and hopefully leapfrog, I think that's a huge benefit. And there'll be a lag between developing and developed nations in terms of what they do. But just in terms of Kyoto, I just want to make one point about Kyoto. There are a number of really great things about the Kyoto Protocol, and one of them is the Clean Development Mechanism. Now, the Clean Development Mechanism is a way to which developed nations can deploy and transfer technologies in developing nations all around the world and use those as offsets towards their own emissions. And then the CDM, it has about 800 projects in the pipeline and is going to, from estimates, avoid about 2.5 billion tonnes of CO2 by the year 2012. That's a great effort, and half of those are going to be in China. So by China being part of the protocol, yes, they don't have to abide by emissions targets, but there's important mechanisms to which they are actually being part of the process. So I think there's a lot of good things about Kyoto. I don't think we should abolish it at all. We should be part of the process and leading the charge and to develop a system whereby which post-2012 we can see really stringent action on all different fronts, not just emissions targets.